at 9. Ed?
Thank you.
We need to vacate, so that didn't come up.
Accept it.
Oh, it's just Ed. Who doesn't want to be here?
That's the implementation.
You want the podium, you want whatever you want. That'll be the hot seat for today.
Good morning again.
Good morning. Afternoon.
Good morning.
I love the tie.
I didn't have to.
Holiday spirit. So this is great. We're finally here. This is, you know, what we always preach as investment consultants, that the board's primary function and the key decision to be made when reviewing your portfolio and constructing your portfolio is the asset allocation. And so here we are today, having laid a lot of groundwork. Before I get into it, let me see if there are any questions or anything you should refresh on, because we did the investment strategy development work at the workshop. And coming out of that, the conclusion was to look further into what we conveniently named the FFP, the Functionally Focused Portfolio Approach, as well as the Risk Diversified Model, and take a deeper dive into those two, which is what we're seeking to do here today. Does that sound like a good place to start? Does anyone have anything we should address up front? Okay, great. So I'm seeing head nods. So in the deck that you have, we have a few sections that help us keep things in perspective. And the first is just a quick plan profile page. And the plan profile helps us remember what that AL study had in it. So the AL study helping us to keep in mind what the liability profile looks like and what we're trying to really accomplish here. Because we all heard from you that the key goal of the pension plan is to meet the beneficiary payments. So we want to keep that first and foremost. Page 4 outlines that. Total assets, where we stand today, a little over $7 billion. Then we have some cash flow details, with total contributions on a monthly basis coming in at about $27.7 million. That's the average over the past 2 years. And that's employer and employee contributions. We have the total benefit payments of about $34 million. There's actually a typo in that. That should be 33.2. And the reason for that typo is the operating expenses is overstated. It shows 3.2. That was just an error in our Excel spreadsheet. That number should be 2.4. But that doesn't really change anything at the end of the day. The picture is the same. So net operating cash outflow is accurate, $5.6 million. That's what we're seeing coming out of the plan, month in, month out basis, without accounting for interest and dividends. And once we add in the interest and dividends, we are positive on a cash flow basis here today. But that profile is changing, which is why we're bringing this to your attention. And then some of the nice actuarial statistics about our assumed rate of return and our funded ratio in the bottom of that page. As we turn to the next section, then, cash flows, you know, we can see what we're looking at historically on page 6 in the bottom left-hand chart, and what we're looking at on a projected basis in the bottom right-hand chart. And you can see here why the projections change. So 2023 is where we're anticipating to be darn near fully funded. I think the projected rate there is something like 97%, or a little north of 97. And because we get so fully funded at that point, the UAL component of the employer contribution really falls off. So it's just the normal cost method. And then the resulting then is the net operating cash flows, the orange line drops off. And so that's different than what we've seen the past 10 years versus what we expect to see over the next 10 years. So we have to prepare for that.
Well, isn't that contribution, is that also the investments we're getting? Obviously, 97% of time we're getting more from investments.
Great question. And so that would be our segue in page 7. So on 6, it does not account for interest or dividends. It is just net operating cash flow. Add in interest and dividends, and we call it total cash flow. And so there the picture does change. You can see the bottom left is consistently positive, thanks to that investment income. Bottom right, also generally positive out to 2023. And so that turns slightly negative. That's a long ways away. But you can see we're generally a healthy plan from a cash flow perspective for the next 10 years. So it's looking pretty good. Page 8 then just helps us keep in mind, again, these actuarial statistics of where we stand on a funded basis, a funded ratio historically and projected. So this is where you can see that 2023 we get very close to the 100%. I think 2024 is actually where we're projected to be fully funded based on our actuarial assumptions today.
You're going to be around that long?
Okay, so that's a good backdrop. We want to keep that in mind. I don't think there's much that's objectionable in that. Like I said, it's a brief recap of the AL study.
I hope so.
When we turn to page 9 and we get into the next section, this is benefits and expenses projection. And the reason why we have this is because the key part of the FSP is having a sort of reserve model, that we have enough money stored in cash in very safe vehicles, investment vehicles with very low volatility, so that that pool of cash can pay the benefits over the next X time frame. And so these three pages model out whether we want to have that time frame be 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years, 24, 36, or 48 months. And so page 10 shows you how we're doing that calculation. And what we're doing is taking the projected expenses on page 10, I'm looking at the left right-hand box, and saying, okay, our two-year projections are $446 million in 2017, $468 million in 2018. Combine those, that's $914 million that we want to have in reserve. As we look at our projected end-of-period assets for 2016, $7.75 billion, that means we would then have to hold pretty close to 12% in cash. And so we have that all charted out, and you can see the low on this page 10 is 10.7%. The high is the 11.7%, so somewhere in that range, and we kind of think of that as we need 12%. And so 12% in cash and short-term vehicles for the 24-month reserve model. Similarly, page 11 and 12 do the same thing. So instead of 12, it becomes 18% in cash, and the 48-month model would be 24% in cash.
So in the reserve thinking, is the concern or the driver the market collapse scenario? What type of disruption drives is a driver in the reserve calc for the need to have X years of benefits payments available? What was the most important driver?
So the most important driver is market volatility and market illiquidity. And the reason why we have both of those is thinking that market volatility, like what we experienced in 2008, all assets decreased in value. We could ride that out with a model like this because from the 2008, or actually early 2009 bottom, to a recovery through that, you know, it started recovering in 2009, so 2010, 11, 12, we could essentially ride that out without any issue because we have that reserves. And so you could look at your investment pool and say, yes, we're accepting that investment risk, but we're not concerned about that. We know we're fulfilling our primary obligation of being able to pay pension benefits. It then has the illiquidity component because where we invest those investable assets may not be just the publicly traded stocks and bonds that we're used to, but more of these private investments. And there we don't want to or expect that we could get out of those easily in a market dislocation time like 2008 without taking a big haircut. We wouldn't want to have to do that. So this would give us comfort saying, yep, they decreased in value, we can ride that out. The third component that is a benefit but not necessarily a key driver is that in a market dislocation like that, we would have reserves that we could then, as a board and consultant and staff, review opportunities in the market and say, there are some good buying opportunities here, and we have cash reserves. Depending on how we model the reserves out during that time and where we feel comfortable, that may create buying opportunities for us for future returns. That's, again, ancillary.
So that piece of the liquidity aspect gives the system the ability to be nimble. In other words, it isn't about meeting a cash obligation over here. It's potential cash flow to take advantage of something, you know,
right.
Opportunity in the market.
So if you had that kind of three-year reserve, and you said now there's some great buys, you would dip into that three-year reserve, maybe lower to 2 years?
We would take a look and bring that to the board. So that would clearly be a board decision, and it would be the kind of analysis where we'd want to take a look at, you know, this kind of thing at that time, see what our projected benefits and expenses look like, understand health of the sponsor, is there any reason we wouldn't expect the sponsor to be able to maintain right. the contribution. If there is, we'd probably say, let's just keep it safe.
Yeah, I was the simple math to me was, I guess at $35 million a month, it's like $442 million a year, right, is the annual nut. So a $7.1 billion fund, just in static and current dollars, and these to throw off like a 6% cash. If solely the fund were generating the money, it's like a 6% cash requirement to have it throw off to meet the nut. But we meet it by the combination of employer-employee contributions and then investment earnings. And so there's a sweet spot. I don't know what it is. I'm curious as to what the shortest period you think is defensible for the reserve period, you know, on the principle of not having cash or liquidity yield, you know, idle, low return, versus the need to be nimble and have
go
that.
Go ahead and join in up here.
I like the concept. Time over the weekend trying to, you know, really get into this a little bit and understand it.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to understand where those sweet spots are in terms of the systems need to meet the nut, including employer ability to pay and all of those factors that go into that, how often you make an assessment of that, and then taking those reserve needs that are cash flow reserved to meet the nut requirements into account, how much you might want to have aside to be the nimble investor and take advantage.
Cash optionality.
There's got to be an optimality scenario that you can calculate that I would think, or maybe several, I don't
know. Somewhere between 2 and 4 years of reserves.
So it's somewhere between 2 and 4, but yeah. So the minimum appears to be 2.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the thought process that went into this was, there's not much point in modeling out a single year. We're roughly there today in terms of the employer and employee contributions roughly come in at about 10 months of benefit payments. So a one-year reserve model is not terribly dissimilar from our current position. And so we modeled this out and said, you know, 2 years is probably your minimum. So what does 2 years get you? Well, 2 years you can ride out a short-term dislocation in the market and draw that down, and you would understand that, you know, most drawdowns as they occur stay within that 24-month window. So it's the bare minimum of insurance that we think would be appropriate to consider. And the 3 and 4 year models provide you with a little bit more optionality about how do you want to think about those longer dated hedges. So with a 3 year model, now you've got enough to ride out a short term dislocation, which is usually peak to trough. The historical average has been how many months?
I don't know that number, but it's, most of these are very short. 2008 right. is a long exception.
Right. But typically 12 months, 18 months. So enough to ride out that and have a little bit more cushion around it. A 4 year, you've got a lot of duration hedged out. You've got 4 years. I mean, if nothing happens, you make no further allocations, and there is global turmoil, you can pay every benefit payment for 4 years. What that allows you to do is also those longer dated ones, so the things that you've hedged out, this was today, things that you've hedged out in 2018, well, maybe I don't, you know, we start to get through a market dislocation when we say, maybe I don't feel like I need those 2018 hedges anymore. I can take those, sell those off, and buy something else. So 2 year is the minimum. The 4 year provides you that buffer plus a little bit of flexibility. And so, you know, the conversation with the board is 2 to 4 years, where is your comfort level here? And so, you know, Scott, you're looking for a sweet spot. This is more of a comfort conversation.
So this percentage of assets, does that take into account the expected contributions that are going to come in a given year?
Yes.
It does. So the 2 year is really a 3 year because you're in your current year, and the 3 year is really a 4 year because you're...
No, but what we're doing here is saying the cash flow that comes in, we now have the flexibility to use that cash flow coming in from the employer and the employee to buy, you know, current protection, mm-hmm. to buy a diversifying asset, or to buy a growth asset. We can have that conversation about where is the best place to deploy that money today.
Because it might not be just to buy, you know, another couple of years of benefit payments. It might be a 2009 period where equities are really cheap, and we would prefer to boost the equity exposure there. So we've taken that contribution and said, you know, we've got a high degree of certainty about that coming in, but let's have a conversation about what the highest and best use of that contribution is, and not necessarily say it's automatically going into the short-term portfolio.
But if things are really bad, you have that additional.
You would have two,
liquidity coming in on an annual basis.
Well, I'd answer that question a little bit differently. What we did was we modeled it in terms of just looking at what 2 years' expenses mean under different assumptions. When we then talk about operationally, when that cash flow comes in, do we want to have that then get us to back up to the target? Is 36 months the high end? Is that the median or is that the low end? And so that's more of an operational question. We can think about how we implement that. So
the incoming cash flows are, we're kind of setting them over here to see how we want to use them, because we already have liquidity or sufficient liquidity for either a 2 or 3 year period. My second question was, in the 24-month reserve model, it's really a 36-month reserve model because we're already working on a one-year model. So it's actually years 2 and 3.
Right. So that's what I was getting to. So that 12% kind of number, we would look at that 12% and say that's the number we want to have a target after the employer contribution comes in. That brings us back up to 12.
Okay.
And then it draws down over the course of the year. Or we could say, no, we want 12% to be the minimum when that employer contribution, that takes us up to 18. Mm-hmm. So that would give us like a 3 year, but it will draw down over the course of the year back down to 12. Yeah. So that can be an operational consideration. Right now, we're just agnostic to.
Ed, I was going to ask you just to expand. Expenses are all in cash. Return is a combination of appreciation, presumably, and cash. So we don't necessarily have all the cash that a return would suggest. What we have are securities that have appreciated. But we have to pay the expenses in cash. Where does this take that into consideration?
So that takes into consideration this middle section. And what we're doing here, if we're on page 10, what we're doing here is we're taking a look at the total plan balance, total assets under these return assumptions. And we generally are using the 7.25% return assumption. And we're saying that end of year, the account balance grows in 2016, $7.75 billion. So it's the red box under total assets.
But that grew in part in cash and in part in appreciation. That's the distinction.
It's the total return on the total portfolio, including the cash. So including cash basically at zero or close to zero, and the return on the other assets, the growth side of the portfolio.
All right. So you're basically you're treating it as all appreciation then, or substantially all.
You're not including the prepayment.
Right. The contributions are figured into that increase in portfolio balance?
Yes.
Okay.
As far as the impact on the sponsor, we've got that 5-year smoothing, right? So that also kind of takes into effect how much risk we take as far as the sponsor has to contribute towards the UAAL.
The 5-year smoothing,
yes. Yeah. So even though if we do have the dip, like we said, we're doing more risk, they're not going to get impacted that year. They'll have it over the 5-year.
Right. Now, this is the conversation we're having today is a little bit more of the operational nature of, you know, how do we want to choose an asset allocation and what portfolio construction process do we want to go through. And, you know, as Ed said, the conversations around FFP would be your desired number of months of benefit payments in reserve, your minimum number of months, and your maximum number of months. So it's really getting a comfort level of where is that number of months, how far would you like to draw it down, and then we can get a picture of that. There is a, you know, inherent in the portfolio construction process and inherent in the cash flow is this idea of motion. Money comes in, gets invested, gets drawn down, gets replaced. The models here are static. And so the models are going to be approximately correct. And, you know, you're looking for where are the contributions and all of that sort of thing. These are kind of neutral middle ground snapshots, and then we can talk about the operational nature around some of this.
Harvey?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, but as far as the risk, you had to give it a number, like if we do what we're currently doing, the FFP, how much more risk for volatility are we taking? I think people can understand or
get to that. So actually, I like that. I'd like to put a placeholder on this discussion because we're going to come back to it when we think about the overall portfolio construction. So because one part of what we're trying to solve for is the question of how many months of reserves do we want? The other dynamic we're trying to solve for is how does that allocation of reserves impact the overall portfolio? And so it's a bit iterative.
Okay. Let me ask Harvey, you have a comment?
Thank you. I recognize that we want to focus on asset allocation here. I do want to pick up something that Gabe alluded to, which was maybe something more peripheral, which is impact on plan sponsor. And I want to ask a question here. This approach is essentially an insurance policy, or a type of insurance against fiscal crisis situations. And I'm wondering if by doing this we're creating some kind of a moral hazard with regard to the plan sponsor. So let me give you a historical note on that. In the late 80s, when the markets tanked, the governor looked at CalPERS and said, well, you've got enough on hand to meet your obligations for the next couple of years. Therefore, we're having such a budgetary crisis here in the state. What we'd like to do is delay for a year making our contributions into the system, and they did that. And ultimately, it worked through the courts, and that's what created Prop 162 in 1992. There's a temptation by the plan sponsors when they're facing fiscal crisis to look at the retirement system and say, well, you've got this wonderful process in place where you have liquidity and you're not worried about our contributions coming in. Why don't we just delay our contributions for a year? That has nothing to do with our approach on asset allocation, but it's something that we don't live in a vacuum. I think we need to take into account that we may be creating what I would call a moral hazard here for the system, in that it's going to create a temptation possibly for our plan sponsors to say, you don't need our money for the next 2 years, you've got a reserve already in place that you've already accounted for.
Is that any more or less a possibility than reaching 100% or 110% funded level and they say you guys are doing fine? I mean, I understand there's always that temptation.
A little bit, because we've put down a marker that we have a you notice the word reserve is used here. Mm-hmm. So that's all. I think it's probably a little more encouraging. That's not to suggest that we wouldn't go this approach, and I like this approach, frankly, as a prudent exercise of looking at the functional needs of your portfolio to meet your primary goals. But I do want to just put that out publicly, that it is something to think about in terms of how the plan sponsors may view in a crisis situation that we may be creating a temptation that wouldn't otherwise be there.
So what is our alternatives? We just took the fire department to task. So what's our alternative? To do the same? If the plan sponsor suddenly decides, okay, you've got this great plan, we're in crisis, so we're going to, I mean, our alternative is to go to court.
Our alternative is to sue our county.
And what was the experience with CalPERS when the state had
5 years of litigation.
But what was the end result?
The end result was the Supreme Court said the governor was wrong and
you had to pay.
Yeah.
So there is some
Prop 162. So
okay.
Did PEPRA do away with I know it was the holiday, but isn't that similar kind of thing?
What's that?
PEPRA's no longer allowed the pension holidays. Isn't it sort of the same thing where they
it wouldn't be like a pension holiday, it would just be self help, we're not paying you. I don't want to derail the conversation by any means, but I do want to sensitize the board to the fact that we need to think about outside our four walls what the impact of our decisions are.
Yeah.
I mean, whether you
Thank
call
you
it
for
a,
that.
whether you call it a reserve or not, essentially what we're looking at is the amount of total risk that we're willing to take.
Yes.
And what we're doing is taking one portion of that and allocating it to a larger portion to a lower risk mm-hmm. asset class than we have right now.
Right.
And that allowing us to go out on the other end and invest in less liquid, possibly higher return, possibly higher risk assets. But the total portfolio, we still have the same amount of risk here.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, I understand, I mean, it's a very intellectual take on this whole thing, but I don't think really there's a change here. It's just how we're allocating assets.
And
do we call it a reserve? Do we call it just an allocation? I don't know.
It's an allocation.
That would be
and
right.
Reserve is in quotes.
Yeah.
Yep, right.
For this yeah. No, it's a. I understand, Harvey, your comment, but I think the goal here is to create an operationally more resilient approach.
Sure. Absolutely.
Fully and agree. It's a very holistic approach. It says we have a funding policy in place. Plan sponsors play by the rules to get to a better outcome.
Are there any other systems that have adopted this kind of approach? 37X systems?
This approach is something we've seen elsewhere. So San Bernardino comes to mind as having similarities to what we're discussing, but in a different way. And I think their end result of asset allocation is different. The approach that we're talking about here, where we're assessing the liquidity needs of the portfolio and what it's designed to meet, and then constructing a portfolio to meet those, is the exact approach espoused by the Yale model, which is a foundation endowment model that is often misinterpreted, but it is exactly what Swenson did there. It is something that we see with medical plans, where cash flow is very important and they manage the cash flow in that way. So we see bits and pieces of this from all other angles. Might be the first county in California to formally approach it, but
I'm glad to see us start thinking this way. This is something that I've suggested in the past.
Most systems are focused now on risk mitigation techniques, and this is in that spectrum of things. And Veris is extremely conversant in mm-hmm. in this field. And I mean, I think it's an excellent, creative approach as an alternative to just a risk mitigation scheme that focusing on the functionality of what you're doing is really good. But I haven't seen this identified specifically like this elsewhere yet, but these kind of approaches are what is now in currency and across the state.
Yeah, and I think it's the conversation that we're engaged in is probably a similar conversation that a lot of plan sponsors are facing. What do we need the asset pool to do for us? And it's no longer grow in a risk-diversified manner. It's provide future growth, but we have identified that paramount role of providing the benefit payments. And we know that going forward, more and more of that is going to have to be generated off the investment portfolio. So the ideas here, we're kind of going from this legacy of allocating to asset classes. A lot of the risk conversations are allocating risk factors because they're perceived to be more stable and closer aligned with what the plan sponsor is trying to accomplish. We're just pushing all the way through that and saying, what do we as an organization want the investment portfolio to do? Let's allocate those priorities, and let's align segments of the portfolio to meet those priorities. And so it's just kind of a, in my mind, it's the natural progression of the conversations that are going on nationwide.
It maintains the growth potential as opposed to some of the ERISA plans where they basically laddered bond maturities to meet their cash flow needs at nearly 100%.
Yes. It borrows some of the ideas from liability-driven investing, which is what Brian's describing there, but it applies them to the near term. So we buy that stability. Once we've bought that stability, what do we, as a long-term plan, how are we able to allocate those growth resources? And so we start to have the conversations about, We have bought, you know, certainty. We have bought a high degree of meeting that primary objective of paying all the benefit payments. That's locked down. Okay, now mentally, what are we able to do with our risk budget? What are we able to do on deployment of long-term growth assets? And really, it is meant to, a lot of this is providing a communication tool. We can communicate what the fund is doing a lot more easily under this approach, in my estimation, we can. And we have bought the ability to go through market dislocations without having to look at our portfolio and say, okay, our liquidity profile is changing in real time. We went through 2008 to pay benefit payments. Our bond portfolio, as part of them, became illiquid. Mm-hmm. So there are segments of the portfolio where we're willing to accept that interaction with other investors and, you know, the potential for a liquid asset becoming illiquid in a time of distress. And there are times in the portfolio where we need to guarantee that cash flow, either through a laddered bond portfolio or contractual income, and just aligning those. So I think it just says what it does. It communicates different measures of success, and it's a better alignment.
One thing we know for sure, Tim's and Chi-Chi's and Jeff's names will be legendary in years to come. We just don't know why.
Long after we're gone,
that, Jerry.
We'll still be talking about you.
With that, Ed, would you like to continue?
Yes, I would. Let's take a look at page 15. This is probably what you're more used to seeing when we have an asset allocation discussion. How are we going to allocate all of the assets? And here we have the models broken out. So before we get into the decimal points and where they should be on each one of these asset classes, let's just go across the top here for a brief minute. We're modeling out here the policy as it stands today. The next column is FFP. ISD, that's the FFP model that we showed you at the Investment Strategy Development Workshop. So that was the reference point. That's the one that we looked at and said, this is something worth pursuing. What we're going to do then is blow that out into the different models across the right. The next column is risk diversified, 50, 25, 25. And this was the model that was also asked that we consider in this process. So again, it's not as focused on cash, it's more of a traditional have everything fully invested, but do it in a risk diversified way where we're not getting as much risk from equities themselves per se, which is the chief source of risk. And then we have two sets of FFP columns, FFP 2, 3, and 4 year and unconstrained FFP. The difference between these two is basically saying, okay, well, we're going to hold the amount of cash that we're set up to do 2, 3, or 4 year allocations. But with the unconstrained, we're going to say, okay, what if we did whatever we want to do with the remainder? In other words, what do our current capital market assumptions and risk return drivers show us as being the best, most efficient allocation? What can we do here? And so unconstrained does just that. It doesn't have regard for how much we have in private assets, private equity or private credit. It doesn't have a care in the world about how much we have in emerging markets or any other risky asset class, just what's the best that we can do. So it's not just an exercise either, because a key part of having the cash reserves in the FFP model is that you know you can take risk with the growth portfolio. So why wouldn't you? And so it really opens up that door and says, what is possible here? So that's the basic outline. You can see the asset allocation done here across each of the asset classes, as well as our capital market assumptions on the right-hand side. These are our 10-year return expectations for the asset classes. The vol is the volatility measured by annualized standard deviation. And the Sharpe ratio is the excess return for the volatility that you get, which is an indicator of efficiency. How efficient are these asset classes? So that's page 15. Page 16 then says, okay, so what if we realign these asset classes and think about how much we have for liquidity, how much we have for diversifying, and how much we allocate to the growth portfolio. And so today you see that your policy is set up to have basically 0.5% in cash. Keep as little in cash as possible, invest the rest. Then diversifying assets, which we're labeling as U.S. Treasuries and risk diversifying strategies, we have no allocation to today. And so the rest is all in the growth bucket. Principally global equity and then you can see the breakout across the other asset classes. And some of these asset classes do have diversifying characteristics as you put them together. Some move up when others move down. All of them have return generating capabilities, even at the cash level. So these are kind of shades of gray, but it's a convenient mental bucketing of how we do it. And then you can see across the others, the FFPs in particular, how much we're allocating to the liquidity side, how much we're allocating to diversifying, and how much we're allocating to growth. So it's really those blue lines that we're trying to highlight on 16. 17 then is the punchline. Okay, so what? And here on page 17, we can see what the expected returns are for each of these portfolios. And so the top line, as a result of mean variance analysis, which is the common tool we use for portfolio construction, is what is the forecast 10-year return for each of these portfolios? And let's just digest that line for a moment. Current policy, as we see it, modeled with our capital market assumptions, will generate a 6.4% annualized return over the next 10 years. So we know that that number is well below 7.25, our target assumed rate. So there's a decrease there. Also, with the policy, we currently have an annualized standard deviation of 12%. So that's how much we should expect to go up and down in an individual year away from the forecasted annualized return. And then two lines below that, the first percentile return 1 year, which you see is minus 33%. That's one of the indications. We have a number of indications in this book, but that's one of the indications of what's the real drawdown risk here. How bad is a bad year? And that's saying any given year, there's a 1% chance that we would lose 33% with this portfolio. Granted, they could be worse, but that's one metric to look at it. Now let's take that and work across the options here. So FFP, as we modeled at the workshop, forecast 10-year return a little bit higher, 6.5%. Standard deviation much lower, 9.4. So it's a more efficient portfolio. And the downside risk here is minus 24.4%. So good, we've saved ourselves about 8.5 percentage points on the downside. Risk diversified gives us a higher return, slightly lower standard deviation than where we are today, and about the same downside risk, minus 31%. And then the FFPs. Now the FFPs are interesting because when we take a look at the constrained versus unconstrained, we see that the unconstrained gives us higher expected returns because we're able to do with the growth portfolio whatever we see, wherever we see the best returns. And we see that the unconstrained relative to the standard FFP does have a higher standard deviation and has greater drawdown risk. But you notice that across the board, all of these model out to have less drawdown risk than where we currently are. All of the FFPs modeled out have higher expected forecast returns than where we are today. And all of the FFPs have a lower standard deviation than where we are today. In other words, they're more efficient portfolios. They have a better risk return profile across the board. So, and it's also interesting that even when we talk about having 4 years, doesn't that sound like a lot in cash? Doesn't that sound like we're giving up a lot in yield? But because it's almost a barbell approach, we have so much in cash that is safe and preserved that we're allowed to take more risk with the growth portfolio, that this barbell approach works out so that the returns, you don't lose anything by having that higher allocation. So a fun little exercise for the academic in you, for the board committee member in you, these are the things we need to now think about in terms of what's the right trade-offs to make. Let me take you back then to page 15. Because at the bottom of page 15 is something we wanted to highlight is the allocation to illiquid strategies. And this bottom line, which you're seeing today at 20.4%, is a combination of real estate at 8% and private equity at 12.4%. When we move across, we also include the private credit line. And so you can see FFP from the workshop had 40% in the liquids. This is the part that gives us some pause because what's the right number here? In a market dislocation, that's the percent of assets we do not expect to be able to touch, period, end of story. We would wait for those commitments to mature on their own. Some would naturally mature during the market dislocation process, but we wouldn't reach out and pull those out early. So we wanted to note that. And this is where FFP versus unconstrained FFP have a real noticeable difference, where we're in the 30% range versus the 40% range. as we jump back to page 18, we have more of a pictorial representation for you. The same numbers, just shown graphically. Page 19 has risk contribution by asset class. And so the purpose here is to say, okay, here's the volatility of our policy on the left-hand side at 12.1%. Where does that 12.1% come from? Mostly from the equity, the brownish color. The next largest portion from private equity. So you combine those two, and it's really an equity-centric portfolio. That doesn't change dramatically in terms of the sources across. You can see that even with FFP 2, 3, and 4, we're still getting our principal risk exposure from those two equity buckets, so it is slightly more diversified. The cash component draws it down pretty significantly, though, which is why you see the volatility in general coming down. Page 20 has risk contribution by risk factor. So as opposed to looking at your asset allocation just by asset classes, we're going to break apart and look at it by factors, and these factors are rates, interest rates, credit exposure, equity, inflation and currency. Other just makes it all tie together. Again, these portfolios aren't dramatically different. We're still getting most of our risk exposure from equities because that's the source of economic growth long term. Next largest component is basically currency, and that's because we have a significant international component to the equities modeled in here as well. Page 21 has a series of stress tests, and these are point-specific stress tests where we take a portfolio and we want to stress it in one particular way and no other. And so at the top we say, what if the U.S. dollar appreciates by 20%? What does that do to the portfolio? And the top blue bar is where we currently are with policy, and then FFP, risk diversified, then the series of 2, 3, and 4 years, constrained and unconstrained. And you can see here that U.S. dollar appreciating, depending on which portfolio we select, may have better, similar, or worse downside if the U.S. dollar appreciated by 20%. What's interesting about these stress tests is that you get to pull apart one point and look at it. What's unrealistic is that when you take one point, that's not how the world works. Everything else is going to adjust in combination. So if the U.S. dollar appreciates, that's going to have an impact on the bond market and the equity markets and all of those good things. So in that respect, it's somewhat unrealistic, but it is worthy of taking a look along that dynamic. Pages 22 and 23 take a look at it from a historical perspective. And so these run the portfolios through events that actually have happened with specific dates as to when they start and stop, which are in the appendix. And we take a look at the portfolios here. So looking at the top, 2009, July to January, what happened here? The portfolio that we're currently invested in does extremely well. It's only bested by the unconstrained 3 and 4 year models. On the downside though, 2007 to 2009, the model doesn't do as well. And so you can see there that it is bested by all of the others except for the FFP unconstrained 4 year, which has the same downside exposure. And so you can see each one of these then. The dot-com slowdown, oil price rise. Oil price rise is interesting because only the risk diversified portfolio really does well in that scenario.
So the dot-com on the policy did better than the FFP 2 year as an example, right? 2001 dot-com slowdown.
So 2001 dot-com slowdown.
One time where the policy did better than the FFP 2 year or any of the FFPs?
That's right.
Okay.
So any of the unconstrained FFPs. The constrained FFPs actually did better, yeah.
They were less negative.
Less negative, that's what I'm found. You're right. It's less negative. Just out of curiosity, why, when you look at the subprime or the dot-com, how does that impact our investments? Is it just because the whole market took it, or is it because you may be invested in some of the, like mortgage-backed security kind of thing, or the...
It's because the whole market took it, and it's your proportional weights to each of those indices that make up the whole market.
Ed, is the current international economic environment consistent with what you would think it should be based on historical stress test kind of analyses, like what happened in oil price declines or oil price rises? So right now, as we sit here today, we have incredible oil price decline, mineral declines as well. Looks to me, I was listening to something on the radio yesterday about just the bottoming out and continuing to drill down, excuse the pun, Jerry, on you know, mineral ore extraction, all that kind of stuff. You know, equities have been choppy internationally. Is the economy behaving as you thought it would in an oil price decline scenario?
So yes and no. A is that we're still watching it play out. So the near-term effect of an oil price decline is going to have an immediate impact on exploration and production companies, the E&P, and it has in a big way. Right. And so those high-yield bonds have not done well, and as expected, because those companies are going to have trouble meeting their bond covenants, et cetera. What's interesting will be to see how long then it plays out, because that will be the driver. Lower oil is a good thing for all of the other companies in the world and consumers, because it's an input cost to us. And so the input cost will lower our cost basis and therefore allow us to have higher earnings, which is a great thing. So that will play out over time. We're not there yet. So
yeah, it's from what I'm hearing in the near term, people aren't doing with the excess cash what the economists maybe thought they would do with it, which is spend it.
Yeah. S&P 500 earnings that came out along these lines that we just got through the reporting quarter, we finished down close to 2%. Earnings decreased 2% from the prior quarter, which beat expectations. They were supposed to decrease by 5%, so we lost less than we thought. But if you pull out energy, the energy sector, they were up 6%. So the rest of the economy is, the rest of those companies in the S&P 500 are doing okay, which is good.
Is it any of that money going towards paying off personal debt?
The consumer balance sheet has been getting better and better and better since the global financial crisis. Only within the last couple of quarters have we seen an uptick, and we probably want to see an uptick, because the consumer has not been able to borrow, and because they're now able to borrow, that's an indication that the banks are willing to lend them money and have more confidence that they have jobs, that their income is increasing, and those kinds of drivers. So it has upticked marginally. We'll see how it plays out. But
keep in mind, every single forecast in here, I can guarantee you, is wrong.
Thank you, Tim.
No, I mean, we want to take a look at this and say, directionally, are we heading in a better direction or a worse direction? The precision here is just not reasonable to expect that we can fine-tune this, and that an oil price rise in the future will be like an oil price rise in the past, because it is an intersection of, as Ed said, you know, you have the ripple effects. The subprime market hit the equity market, hit the real estate market, you know, hit the banking sector. Oil price decline causes geopolitical unrest elsewhere. Oil price rises cause, you know, export-heavy countries to have geopolitical unrest in the other direction, and they lock down because they have more revenue coming in. So we know there's a dynamism here. We don't know what the future is going to look like, but we can say directionally from where we are positioned today, are we likely to have increases or decreases in the expected volatility, increases or decreases in the expected standard deviation, and therefore, are we moving to a more efficient measure or not? And implicit in FFP is we have the ability to ride out a lot more turmoil.
Tim's cautionary note also applies to all actuarial calculations that
yes.
we
yeah.
get.
Yeah. Yeah,
100% certainty will be 90% wrong.
I know you were going to give me a ride home, but forget it. Call Uber.
I wouldn't have relied on that prediction.
Oh. So along those lines, these historical scenarios haven't played out again, right? We've never seen that. It introduces the third component to scenario analysis with risk managers, is to create a scenario. So not only do we take stress tests and say, what if the dollar did this, or what if equities did that, create a whole combination and say, this is a scenario we want to test, that's a hypothetical test, and that just creates tons of arguments about, no, that's not going to happen because of this. So yeah. That's you're not seeing that here, and we haven't agreed on a scenario worthy of consideration yet. Page 24 is something you're somewhat used to seeing now, I think, the heat map approach, where we take these and try to boil it down to the key considerations that are important to you. Not to say that we have the exhaustive set, but hopefully something that helps you think through this exercise. So we have each of the investment models, risk return metrics, and then risk factors, which is a loose term. Portfolio complexity in the bottom half is one consideration, because implementing these strategies is different. So where we are today, we are mainly in publicly traded with some private equity, some real estate allocation. As we get into the unconstrained FFP, that's more exposure there, so it is a higher complexity. Leverage is generally medium across the board. We are not suggesting or modeling in any high leverage positions. We're taking leverage in the portfolio itself. Bless you. Peer and headline risk, you'll look different, right? So as we talked about, we're not seeing other counties do this kind of approach. We're not seeing, we're seeing versions of it and flavors of it, but not as direct. So we think of the FFP that you saw at the ISD and the FFP on constraints as being higher. Your current is much lower, and then the others are in the medium there. Liquidity risk, generally low for all of the FFPs because we have so much in short-term and cash. That's why that's low. Yes, we have a lot in the illiquid, but because we have 2, 3, and 4 year buffers, that's low relative to where we are today. Tail risk, so this is another way of thinking about that downside risk exposure. What if we had just the worst event? And you can see how that tail risk ties into some of the numbers up above in terms of daily VAR and CVAR and drawdown. Drawdown is probably the best way to look at that. And equity risk allocation. So it dials down our equity risk from where we are today.
Expense risk?
Expense risk. Higher expenses. So higher expenses, you'll see with the greater portfolio complexity. So it would model along that pretty well. We don't expect that to have a negative impact on the actual returns, because the expenses, for example, if you had to hire additional staff to implement these, it's not a basis point. You wouldn't expect it to accumulate to a basis point on an annualized basis, so it doesn't even impact that. So yes, higher complexity, meaning higher cost as well.
But Ed, it's fair to say on the expected return line, those are net numbers.
That's right.
Quick question, Ed. Okay, on the FFP ISD, was there a reserve factored into that one or not? Or is there no reserve?
There was a reserve factored in.
For how many months or years?
I believe that's a 2 year.
We can tell you.
15%, 2.5 years.
Yeah.
2.5 years.
Yeah. So we fine tuned that later on. We took a look at this and said, you know, it's really a 6% per year. And we got to the 2, 3, and 4 as being the appropriate range.
Ed, on the bottom one of the risk return metrics, potential impact on discount rate. Not too far down the road, we'll be looking at discount rate again. Is this a reasonable starting point?
Well, this is basically saying, what is the expected return of the portfolio versus the assumed rate? And that's the difference there.
Right.
So it's basically saying if we adopt one of these models, 10-year expectation, we would think of it this way. Your actuarial assumed discount rate is usually a 30-year exercise, so their numbers may come out different using our same inputs into their model. So this is an approximation of it. So yes, I think it's a good starting point, but I think that would also be fine-tuned as we go down.
But it's going to give you an indication of the relative magnitude of potential impact.
Yes.
I can tell you, by the way, that it's not unheard of to actually have time-adjusted discount rates. That is, 10 years out at one rate from the 11th year to the 20th, another, et cetera. You can do that, but most of the power comes in the first 10 years. Any other questions?
Ed?
Tim?
Actually, John, that's interesting. I started having conversations with some actuaries at SACRS on that precise issue on select and ultimate rates. And because they've never gone there, and we're just starting to have that conversation, it's whether it's relevant now. So that's a good point.
It's a little esoteric, but it is certainly done on the private side.
We're making a decision today. Are you going between constraint and constraint, or those two different choices?
Everything on this page, every column here, is a different choice. So I think the question number one would be, Does the board have a preference for risk diversified or FFP flavor? That's the first resolution. Second resolution is, if you prefer FFP, how many months of reserves are you comfortable with? Third consideration then would be constrained or unconstrained.
Give me a, we'll go over unconstrained, because I'm not 100% clear on that.
Okay, so on the reserve portion, on the what we term the liquidity or the provide portfolio, the funding of near-term benefits, those do not change between constrained and unconstrained. The level of investments, the type of investments, are identical. So you see the FFP 3-year and the FFP unconstrained 3-year, that liquidity is identical. What it does is say, on the growth and on the diversified side, let the model go after the assets with the highest expected return, highest expected risk-adjusted return over the next decade. So in other words, what is the probably the asset class with the best entry point today if I've bought that and held that for the next decade, regardless of what its risk profile, well, not regardless, but if it's illiquid, that's fine. If it's heavy into emerging markets, that's fine, if that's the best place to put growth assets today.
Page 16 is probably the best reference point for that one. That's where you can see how the allocation to the asset classes are constructed. When you take a look, for example, at FFP 3-year versus FFP unconstrained 3-year, you see the big difference being in the second line, diversifying assets, going from 12% down to 8% in unconstrained. And the difference there is evenly broken out between U.S. Treasuries and risk diversifying strategies. So that 4% that comes out of FFP diversifying would be allocated across the riskier, the growth portfolio in the FFP unconstrained. And so you see marginal upticks, particularly private equity, private credit at the very bottom. Both of those go from 12 to 16%, which is saying, oh, well, no surprise. If we look over on the right-hand side, those bottom two asset classes have 7.7 and 7.8% expected return. There are the volatility, there's the expected Sharpe ratio. So it's allocating to those asset classes to get that extra return.
Why does REITs go down and all the rest up? And that, I'm talking about the FFP 3-year and the unconstrained FFP 3-year.
The 2-to-1?
2-to-1 as contrasted to all of the others increasing under the unconstrained.
That's us torturing the data.
It's not a material difference.
All right.
It's a round error.
Right. Instinctively, that wouldn't happen.
I think generally, would you say that under the unconstrained, we're seeing a much higher percentage of the growth dollars moving into the real estate and private equity, private credit, and basically the private markets?
Yes.
You do that. And, I mean, to me, looking at the unconstrained 3-year, we would take under the neutral position today, domestic equity down to 8%. That's a very dramatic reduction from where we are today. It would take emerging markets from 0 up to 12%. So we'd have more in emerging markets than we would in U.S. equities. Based upon where today's valuations are looking out, that's a better return profile. Understand, that's a very different risk profile. As Ed said, under the FFP model, we can accept that risk. Question for the board, how far do you want to go on the spectrum here?
Tim, what kind of motion would be the one you would like to see?
I would like to see a motion to adopt one of these columns.
Well, and Scott's going to take us up on that.
I'll take a stab at it.